Well, hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. My guest for this episode is Steve Holloway of MVP Disc Sports, and we're going to be talking about Ender's Game by Orson Scott Card, which won the 1986 Hugo Award for Best Novel. So, Steve, thank you so much for joining me.
Hey, Seth, thanks for having me.
So a while back when I was kind of casting about for future guests for the podcast, I started thinking I want to be more diverse than just talking to other geeky podcasters. And it occurred to me, since I'm a fan of MVP discs and that the names all tend to be scientific, you know, like relativity and teleport and Tesla, that there had to be some nerdy types at MVP. And so I filled out the contact form and I was really, really pleased when you got back to me.
Yeah, actually, that might be one of the best emails I've ever gotten, seeing it come through and saying something along the lines of, you know, hey, I was wondering if there were any people there that, you know, read sci-fi and are into it. And I, you know, we all kind of squeed inside a little bit because, of course, we're all big sci-fi nerds.
Nice.
And we all kind of like, you know, drew straws and played rock, paper, scissors to see which one of us got to be the person to reply and, you know, talk about our favorite books.
All right. Well, if you're not too jealous, I wouldn't mind, you know, pulling other people if they're interested in coming on, because I can always use guests.
Oh, I'm pretty sure I can get some other people for you. In fact, I know a person who, you know, straight up told me that if I picked The Mood is a Harsh Mistress by Heinlein, he might beat me up because that's his favorite book.
All right. Well, you're going to have to tell him that I've already got somebody on the hook for that one.
So, oh, no.
I'm most of the way through that one. And it's scheduled.
It's a good book.
Yeah, it is. So why don't we talk a little bit about MVP? And what your role is there?
Sure. So it's pretty simple and, you know, complex all at the same time. But the title or things of that nature is easy. I am the marketing director and team manager for MVP. So pretty much every piece of material, you know, you see come out from us goes through my desk. And I manage the media department and the graphics department and the marketing department, as well as the social media and the team. So I'm also like managing the professional side of our sports endeavors.
Cool.
Yep.
And for anybody listening to this who's just, you know, garden variety nerds and doesn't play disc golf, why don't you tell them about MVP from that angle?
Sure. So our company's a little bit different. You know, we go with a whole space, science and technology theme, because really what we did is the owners of the company, Brad and Chad, one of them is a math major. The other one is an engineer. And so both, you know, science and math nerds took a look at the disc golf industry and said, you know, there are ways that we can actually improve disc golf technology. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we came up with a gyro technology idea, which is a really practical way of basically increasing the moment of inertia on the outer edge of a rim of a disc. Mm-hmm. And you can go to our website and take a look. We've got a whole technology side where we kind of explain, you know, what it is that we're doing with our stuff. But it was one of those situations where we looked around the industry and was like, nobody's really trying to improve this space in that way. Everybody was just kind of making the same, you know, single plastic injection molded disc. And we were like, let's do something different because one, we can, and two, we know how. And so we went in that direction, and our first disc was the Ion. It was a putter, and we were basically selling them as fast as we could make them. Hmm. And it's been pretty much that way ever since.
Awesome. Yeah. And like, I can't remember if we were recording when I mentioned this, but I found an anode, which is one of the putters, a while back on a course. And then my friends and I did a MVP circuit challenge down in McMinnville, Oregon.
Oh, nice.
And so we got the matrix and the signal and the spin. I subsequently gave those discs to my son, and he got an ace with the spin at our local course here. There's a really short course in Hillsboro. So
excellent.
Yep. So he's like, okay, I want all MVP discs. And so we've got a bag that's all MVP and Axiom. So
awesome. Cool. Good choices.
Yeah.
Spin is a great disc.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about kind of your history as a science fiction fan? Where's that come from? Cause I've had guests that are like me who are more kind of television and movies, and others who are more, kind of formative. Science fiction was books. What about you?
Oh, man. I have to blame my father. So my dad is, you know, one of the biggest book nerds you'll ever meet in your life. When we moved, when I was a kid, we bought like a 53-foot, you know, Ryder truck, like the full-sized truck to move the family across the U.S. Mm-hmm. And my mom, we filled it, like, you know, bottom to top, back to front, and about half of it was books. And when we finally had to move again, you know, my mom said, you need to throw away half of these or get rid of them. And my dad, I think it was one of the first times I ever watched him cry, was trying to decide what books to get rid of. So he was the kind of person who had like two or three books in the bathroom and two or three books at the table and a couple of books in every room. And he would just kind of read them throughout the week, you know, as he was making his way around the house and doing things. So he was always an avid reader. And we were homeschooled. Which, you know, usually comes with a bunch of stereotypes. But sure. One of them that's actually true is that, you know, we really didn't watch TV. We were more like, let's go outside and be active, or let's read or do science kits, you know, type family. And so reading was, you know, when you're homeschooled, like obviously reading is a curriculum based thing. Mm-hmm. But our family's motto was kind of like, you're welcome to read anything you want. So we never really had a prescribed reading list.
OK.
And so because of that, you know, I could read whatever I wanted. Well, my dad's favorite genre was science fiction fantasy. So Isaac Asimov, Clark, let's see, obviously Card, goodness, Heinlein. And so what would happen is he would read something and then he'd turn around and say, hey, you might like this. And, you know, and then I'd end up reading it. And so we went through, I mean, I've read something from every genre. And when I finally got to, you know, going to public school sometime around like junior high, you know, when we got to the reading lists there, they would be like, OK, we're going to read, you know, The Giver. And I'd be like, I read that like 5 years ago, right. And yeah, I'd be trying to do a book reports on something like Sphere by Michael Crichton. Mm-hmm. And they'd be like, well, maybe not something so advanced. I'm like, oh, OK. So we were
right.
We were big readers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we actually we homeschooled our son up until sixth grade. And
awesome.
Unfortunately, he was not really much of a reader. So never has been and still doesn't really like to read. So it's a source of constant shame for me.
It's an interesting thing. I wonder if that's generational. And I say this just because, you know, like for entertainment purposes, right? Like you're in my generation. I mean, yes, we had TV and yes, we were kind of on the bleeding edge of video games. Mm-hmm. And there were plenty, you know, there were Boy Scouts and outdoors things, but that was it. And somewhere after like 7:30, 8 o'clock at night, you know, your options for personal entertainment became spend time with the family or maybe go read a book.
Yeah.
And so for us, it was like a form of escapism, mm-hmm. but escapism is so readily available nowadays that like reading books almost seems like a chore. And I say that because I'm finding that like 90% of my friends that are 20 or younger are like, oh, yeah, I don't read.
Yeah.
And it just, you know, that blows my mind. Like, I can't imagine a world where I don't read a book. But it's very common, mm-hmm. like exceedingly common that they don't read for entertainment purposes. And I understand that because of the amount of things vying for attention. It's just, it's interesting.
Yeah. I think it was a couple months ago. I told my son, hey, I'm going to go, because he was working on homework. I said, I'm going to go in the living room and read. And he went, what for? And I went, I'm reading for pleasure. And that just blew his mind.
Right, right.
So
correct.
So kind of talking about, we were talking before we started recording about how many Hugo winners you've read. I mentioned that when I started this, I had read 12, and now having done it for a little more than a year, I'm up to 22. So I've gained 10. But did you want to reveal your number?
Yeah, you know, you asked me and I thought it was interesting because I was like, oh, I've better read a whole bunch of them. And I went through the list and realized I'd only read 5.
Right.
And as I was going down that list, you know, most people would probably be upset that they'd only read 5. And I was like getting excited because I went, oh, man, there's so many of these I haven't read. Like there's things for me to do. So I actually it was interesting, too, because I had never heard of Farmer in the Sky by Heinlein, which may sound insane because I love some of his other things. But like I'd never heard of it. And so I went, oh, I should definitely look at that because I don't remember that book at all. So, yeah, I'm kind of excited.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of books on the list here that I had never heard of before actually making the list. So,
yeah.
So I'm excited to do it, too. And I like the fact, though, that my guest gets to pick it so that I don't have to read them all in order.
I don't know if that's one of the questions that you're planning on asking me about, like why I picked this. If it is, you know, you can cut me off and I'll stop. But I definitely want to comment on that.
That was pretty much my next question. So.
Oh, perfect. Yeah. All right. Well, then I'll let you lead me into it.
Oh, no. Just go ahead.
Oh, OK. I was really kind of hoping you were going to ask me, you know, like why I picked this, because quite frankly, I was shocked that like Ender's Game hadn't been picked.
Right.
Because in, you know, in almost every like top 100 books of all time, you know, sci-fi edition books, it's always like number one or, you know, number two or number three.
Yep.
And so the fact that other people had done these, I was like, really? There's like no one else picked Ender's Game. It's, you know, one of the greatest like sci-fi books of all time.
Yep.
And then I was more shocked to learn that someone else had done Speaker for the Dead already.
Right.
Which, in my opinion, is the weakest of the books in the Ender's Game series.
Oh, and heresy. So I just,
I know you said that. And I trust me, I actually think that it's the weakest one, which
wow.
I know there are people that disagree with me, but I was like, really? Somebody picked the second one?
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So yeah, no, I was really happy because Ender's Game is easily my favorite book of all time.
Sure.
And there's another author who's kind of creeping into that from the fantasy side. But when we're talking, you know, just sci-fi side of things, then Ender's Game's easily number one, with a very close second from Battlefield Earth, the book, nothing related to that garbage movie. Oh yeah, Battlefield Earth is absolutely phenomenal for reasons people don't really ever think of, but it's a wonderful book.
I haven't read that one, so it's kind of a daunting one because it's a thick one.
It is a tome. Yeah. I will say, you know, there was a day and time when people would pick up a book that size and go, oh man, oof, here we go. But after Harry Potter, I think the idea of reading something that's 600 and 700 pages doesn't really scare people too much.
True.
So when, you know, you've got a book of that nature, like people don't really freak out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's funny though, when, about Ender's Game is when I put out the feeler to some of my friends who podcast, I had somebody choose Speaker for the Dead and I asked her why. And she said, well, Ender's Game is my favorite, but I figure somebody else will want to do it. So she left it for you.
Oh no, I appreciate that.
Yeah. Now it's interesting too, because for me, Speaker for the Dead is the best of the series. So, you never
really know. Oh man, yeah. We're gonna have a good discussion then. I'm excited.
I mean, don't get me wrong, I love Ender's Game, so, but Speaker for the Dead is the one I keep coming back to, so we don't have to recapitulate that. It takes all kinds, right? Your mileage may vary.
We could discuss my problems with the book all day long. I mean, it had some really good themes and notes. Mm-hmm. And I really kind of liked the pacing of the book. I think that Speaker for the Dead has phenomenal pacing. Mm-hmm. For the type of story it's trying to tell,
right? And is a very different story than Ender's Game.
It is a very different story than Ender's Game.
Yeah.
You could almost argue that they were written by two completely different people.
Yeah. I mean, in a lot of the ways they were, right? Because Orson Scott Card was working on Speaker for the Dead and he had already written Ender's Game, the short story or the novella. Mm-hmm. And then he decided to make Ender the main character of Speaker for the Dead. And so he went and turned Ender's Game into a novel to set it up.
Oh, see, I did not know that.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Then that would explain a lot of my issues with Speaker for the Dead then. Mm-hmm. And why it feels like such a weird, you know, juxtaposition between one story being told and then Ender's story within the game or within the book.
Yeah. Well, let's circle back later to talk about the rest of the series, just kind of in general terms, but let's focus more on Ender's Game for now. So just kind of overall thoughts on the book. It sounds to me like you said it's one of your favorites, right?
Yeah, so, I mean, you just want me to launch right into it?
Yeah, I mean, how'd you come across it, and what are your thoughts?
Sure, actually, it's a very interesting situation. I picked it off the shelf based on the cover, which sounds horrible and is almost like a guilty thing that I don't want to mention. But I, you know, my dad and I were at the library, and I was going through the sci-fi section, and I saw Ender's Game. And of course, I think I was like 12 or something like that. I mean, I was really young, but, you know, read stuff. And I walked past it and went, ooh, game. This will be fun. And then I pulled the cover and I opened it and I went, oh, wow. You know, this is a great looking book. And my dad kind of chuckled and was like, sure, you can read a book based on its cover.
Sure.
And then I started reading it. And the first time I read it at that age, there were a lot of things that I didn't understand.
Sure.
And I have this kind of weird thing where I don't ever really read a book twice, except like with very few exception. And it's not because I don't enjoy it. In fact, it's actually because the book is frustrating the second time I read it, because I can look at a page and remember most of what's on the page. And so I start like reading the page and I go, oh, I remember everything on this page. And then I'm like distracted while trying to read the same page again.
Right.
And so I have to wait like 10 plus years to ever pick up a book back up and read it again, with the exception of Ender's Game. And it's because every time I go back into the book, I find something new or learn something new or notice something I didn't notice.
Yep.
Because there's, I mean, you know, people talk about like onions being layers and, you know, using that as a reference in movies and media and books and things like that. But I think Ender's Game is one of the few times I've ever like read a book where I feel like every time I read it again, I'm like learning more subtext, you know, things going on with Graf or his sisters or his brother or whatever.
Mm-hmm. I realized that I skipped over the quick non-spoiler synopsis of the book, or what I call the elevator pitch. And I usually ask my guests to do that. So we don't have to go back and do that or edit it in or anything.
Okay, great. So, you know, non-spoilered version pitch of Ender's Game. I would say if you're the kind of person who really likes to read a book where not only context matters, but the payoff for that context matters, then you should definitely read it. You know, too many times a book is presented to you to be one thing and you get this very, I don't know, like cheap feeling twist or hook at the end of a book or or a change in the story or whatever the reveal is. You don't feel like you earned it as the reader, and you definitely don't feel like the author kind of prepared you to accept it as a reader. Or sometimes you get to the end of a book and it's just, you know, you kind of shrug and be like, well, I mean, the book was great up until it ended, or the book was great up until, you know. And I can tell you that Ender's Game is one of those books. It's like chapter after chapter after chapter. You are constantly rewarded for continuing to read the book because there's just more there. You know, the meat of a book like Ender's Game is just so dense. You know, I would definitely tell you it's not a light read. Like, prepare to be hit with some very heavy concepts and ideas. And with like really rewarding ways of explaining them, too. I mean, this game doesn't shy away from helping you understand why a decision is being made by a character, which too often, you know, is this a PG rated podcast?
Yeah, I try and keep it pretty clean.
OK, so, you know, too often you hear the like, it's magic, I don't have to explain crap, you know, type mentality towards how something happens. And Ender's Game explains enough so that you're not bored with like random fiction numbers, you know, where they start throwing out like multipliers and, you know, oh, yeah, so much thrust per capacity. And they're just really pulling it out somewhere. Mm-hmm. This book doesn't try to do that. What it does do for you, though, is really like help you have an understanding of why the characters make the decisions and what's exactly happening. And in a way that makes, you know, gives you enough like that could happen.
Yeah.
You know, it's sci-fi with like a very small touch of fantasy in the way that like it is fantastical, but it could happen.
Sure.
So that would be my elevator pitch.
Yeah. I mean, kind of jumping off what you said about it's not a light read. I think it's possible to read this in a very surface way and see it as just kind of a military science fiction story with kids as the main characters. And that sounds fun, right? But when you really get into it, you know, Ender really suffers and the things that he goes through are heavy. You know, sometimes if you say this is a heavy book, people are going to be like, oh, this is going to be one that's going to be tough to get through. It is a page turner.
Yeah, no, not that's what I said. It's you're rewarded chapter after chapter. I mean, you're just like you're hungry to get to the next thing because the you know, pacing is fantastic and the book rewards you for continuing to read. You know, sometimes I really hate books that like your friends, you know, recommend to you, but they say, oh, but like somewhere around the middle, you know, it drags really hard.
Right.
You know, or they tell you like just skip 3 or 4 chapters right around here, you know, because nothing happened. Like, this book never does that.
Yeah. I feel like if there's any part that you could say is that way, it would be the stuff that's following Peter and Valentine. Because it's a little different in tone, right? But for me, as somebody who's a fan of the whole series, you know, the Ender's Game, Speaker of the Dead, Xenocide, Children of the Mind, and the Ender Shadow series, it sets so much up in all of those books that that is very rewarding, even those books. Yeah. So,
I mean, if you were to look at it as a standalone, meaning if you didn't know that there were other books and there were no intention for those other books, then I could tell you that there's a lot of, you know, Ender's brothers and sisters stuff that could be taken out.
Sure.
But because of the fact that this is Card and he's writing, you know, not one story, but like 5 stories, then when you take it in the context of like the things happening in the book that don't make sense, and just knowing that he's going to reward you in other books by making those things make sense.
Yeah.
Then I think that, you know, their stories become integral to the concept of the books as a whole. That's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So for me, this is one of, I was always a science fiction fan, and I grew up watching Star Trek. You know, original series was in syndication. Next Generation came out when I was in just starting high school, maybe end of 8th grade.
Sure.
And I didn't read a ton of books. But some of the books I did read were, you know, Star Wars ones and Star Trek ones, but not a lot of the kind of classics of science fiction. And I have some other friends who are nerdy types as well. And they periodically recommend books to me. And Ender's Game was one that somebody said, hey, take this one. We were visiting them. He's like, take this one home with you and then mail it back to me if you want to, or hold on to it. And I read it now, you know, I tore through it in a day and a half. And, and it's been one of those ones that I, like you said, I keep coming back to it. I've read it 4 times, I think, in print. But I also have the audiobook that I've gotten from the library. I ended up buying it. I ended up buying the Nook audiobook as well. So I think I own it in hardcover. I own it for my Nook. I have the audiobook on CD and I have the Nook audiobook as well.
Oh, nice.
And so I think,
how is the audiobook? Because I'm kind of a stickler about, like, the, you know, whoever's doing the reading.
Yeah. It's really, really good.
Good.
The Audio Renaissance, the company that does it, run by a guy named Stefan Rudnicki. I think maybe he has a different company now, but he does a great job of, he does most of the book himself. And then he has somebody else who kind of reads sections that are from a different character's point of view. So like the Valentine sections are voiced by someone else. Yeah, they do a tremendous job. Both Ender's Game and Speaker for the Dead, I can unequivocally recommend as audiobooks. Xenocide, I can't quite so much because there's an unfortunate choice in an accent that's being used for one of the characters on the World of Path, which is a Chinese world. Mm-hmm. And it's a white lady doing a Chinese accent and it's really bad.
Oh no. That's unfortunate.
Yeah. And it's just like, I don't understand what went into that decision or why the director allowed it, you know, or the producer, I guess.
Yeah. I run into that all the time in the fantasy world. I just finished a series by Sanderson and mm-hmm. the guy whoever did the Steelheart series, the reader mm-hmm. is wonderful.
Oh,
like
cool.
I would listen to that guy read anything.
Nice. I enjoyed
and then
those.
You read Steelheart?
Yeah.
Or the Reckoner series? Oh, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
As a young adult novel series, they're wonderful. Like, if you're a kid and you're getting into these books, I recommend them. But, oh, shoot, what did I just start? And it's dribbling out the back of my head. Of course, I'm going to do that.
You're saying you liked the audiobook narrator and you were listening to another Sanderson series.
Yeah, I did. And I switched from that to the 4th Mistborn book. And whoever's reading the 4th one, I cannot stand.
Huh.
It's just awful. Like, they're doing this weird, like what you were talking about, they've got an accent thing with this weird, like, Wild West gruffy voice guy. Mm-hmm. And that works as like a single character, but definitely not the guy who should read the whole book.
Sure.
And so I got like 2 hours into it and just had to turn it off. I was so frustrated.
Yeah. I've found audiobook giveth and audiobook taketh away.
Oh yes. Very
sometimes
true.
I feel like a really good audiobook can make even a bad book bearable. And it can also sometimes expose that this book is not worthy of this narrator.
I have run into that.
So in terms of recommending this book to somebody, on what basis would you do it? You know, if people are fans of other media, other books, how would you recommend it?
In a really weird way, I would tell people that if they like psychological action stories, mm-hmm. that Ender's Game is really where they should go. And I think it was kind of really like the first time I ever came up or thought up of an idea for a genre, you know, psychological action, because you're a psychological thriller, but it's not really a thriller per se.
Right.
But there's just, are we at the spoilers part yet?
No, not quite. Not quite.
Okay. Then I won't go any further, but a psychological action story is really where I would go. Cause like what you were talking about, you can read the book and see it as a surface area book. And then, you know, if you're any good at all about picking up subtext, there's an entire world of subtext inside this book. And so, you know, people who enjoy those kinds of stories, then I would definitely recommend it to them.
Okay.
People who just enjoy like a well thought out world story mm-hmm. should also read this book. Like if you really enjoy like worlds that have deep meaning and context and, you know, or a healthy understanding of where the characters make their decisions from based on what's going on, then absolutely read this book.
Sure. Yeah, for me, I was trying to think of what some comps are, but I've never read anything quite like Ender's Game. And
definitely agree. If you ask me what it's like, I would have to like name 3 or 4 other books.
Yeah.
And say, you know, it's a little bit like a lot of these.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely military science fiction, but it's very different than a lot of military science fiction because it's not, there's not big battles in space that you're seeing. Right.
Right. Well, and they don't spend all of their time, you know, being hung up on pomp and circumstance or procedure or, you know, they spend like just enough time to like help you understand that it is militaristic in some way, shapes and forms, but they don't like constantly drill it into your head when people talk about saluting and standing in line and making sure they march. And, you know,
yeah,
there's enough military story in here that if you're a big military sci-fi fan, you will love this book.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Sun Tzu's The Art of War must have been a heavy influencer for, you know, Ender's Game, because there's a lot that has to do with correlation between the things that Sun Tzu talks about, you know, defeating the enemy and how he goes about doing that. In the tropes found in Ender's Game.
Yeah. So I think it's probably about time to get into spoilers then.
Sounds fantastic.
Okay. So just, you know, for the listener, if you haven't read Ender's Game and you're a science fiction fan, you need to. It's absolutely necessary.
Absolutely.
Like prerequisite reading for calling yourself a science fiction fan. So I wanted to follow up on what you said about psychological action. It sounded like you wanted to talk about what that means in the context here.
Yeah. I mean, if we're at the point where we can start like digging into it.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, go for it. And from this point forward, it's just mostly freeform discussion, and I want you to go ahead and take it wherever you want to, but I did want to follow up on that one thing.
Perfect. No, honestly, psychological action is, I mean, it's a very interesting thing to try to kind of explain, because I'm sure that we view it a lot in other media forms, and, you know, I don't know if anybody's, like, ever defined it, but it's really this concept where even though everything is going on inside of the headspace of one of the characters, or, you know, multiple characters, there's enough intensity to that headspace that you get the same, you know, gritty palm sweats, like elevated heartbeat. You just get, you get pumped up to find out where the character is going to take something in their mind. Even though, you know, they may just, like in the book, they may just be like walking down the hallway, but right, the decisions that they're making and the concepts that they're going through and the, just the weight of what is happening to them and how they're resolving it, you know, is in itself like a moment of action.
Yeah.
And Ender's Game does that in the best way I have ever seen. I mean, these kids deal with some of just the worst possible things.
Yeah.
In a way that like even adults would be shocked to deal. You know, it's like a very adult decision from these kids. And, you know, given the context of the book, it makes sense. But it's when Ender is making the decision about his very first contact with the bully, the decisions going on inside of his head are intense because they happen in just a few seconds in the book. And it's before he even strikes back. But you're watching this child who is, I think he's six.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yep.
6 years old, make these decisions. Now, obviously, he's, you know, a super genius and, you know, way ahead of his time cognitively and things of that nature. So you have to kind of let some of that wash over you and be OK with it. Mm-hmm. But the decisions being made come from such a childlike space that you find yourself as an adult going, yeah, like I get it. Totally, kid, make that choice.
Yeah.
It's a very adult choice, but he gets there in a very childlike manner. And the whole time you're sitting there listening to him make those thoughts in his head, you know where he's going to go and you know he's about to kill this other child.
Right.
And it's intense. It's terrifying. You're just like, holy cow, this 6 year old is going to murder this boy.
Yeah.
And, you know, you could argue it's self defense one way or the other. But, you know, my feelings on it is that even as Ender is building himself to this space, he knows he's about to commit murder. And it's very stressful because he knows I'm stronger, smarter and more in control of myself than you. I also know I'm about to kill you.
Right.
And at this point, he's decided that the other boy does not have the capacity to defend himself against what is about to happen.
Yeah.
So Ender is basically going through the motions of, OK, the bully can't stop me. I'm going to win this.
Right.
And not only am I going to win this, but I have the choice right now to either let it continue, meaning not just the concept of the fight that he's in right now, but like let it continue indefinitely, meaning, you know, let this boy continue to pick up money and all of these guys and let that boy live.
Right.
That's like he's at this space where he's like, I'm either going to murder this boy to stop this problem and all future problems, or I'm going to murder him.
Yeah.
Because it's not just kill this kid. You know, it's not really self-defense because Ender has mentally moved past the idea of just personal self-defense. He knows he could defend himself. Mm-hmm. He knows that if he needed to, he could make sure that he doesn't die. You know, he thinks that this bully, and he puts himself in a situation where it's kind of tense for him. But Ender has basically said, yeah, I'm okay with this. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, he struggles with the decision, but he basically decides to murder a kid in class or at school. And,
I mean, he hates himself for that, too.
Right? Oh, absolutely.
Because he feels like
it's
that's
so deep.
That's where the psychological action comes into it. Right. Because there's the whole influence of Peter, his brother, who is a torturer, you know, and a manipulator. Oh, yeah. And so he despises that part of him. But it's definitely there. And it's part of what helps him become who he needs to be.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, there are some themes in this book that are just constant cyclical referential themes. Yeah. I mean, manipulation being one of the biggest ones. I mean, everyone in this book is manipulating everyone else mm-hmm. around them in a point where, like, every single sentence being said in this book by a character is basically manipulation. Mm-hmm. And that's almost stressful.
Right.
Because I'm the kind of person who, like, I love to read subtext. You know, when sure. somebody says something in a book, I'm always like, oh, does it mean something? And 99% of the time, you know, you're let down because it just means what they actually said.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not a fifth grade book teacher. I'm not going to tell you that the author picked curtains were blue because he was depressed, because the reality is the author actually just thought the curtains were blue, or maybe he had blue curtains at his mom's house and he liked blue. You know, yeah, who cares? Yeah. But with this book, like, every sentence can be like, does that mean something deeper?
Yeah.
And then you find out 15 chapters later that it did.
Yep. Where, like, even when people are actually telling the truth, they're telling you the truth because of reasons, you know, other than just
right.
being honest.
Oh, yeah. Well, every time Graf talks, it's manipulation.
Oh, yeah.
Every sentence, every single thing that man says is manipulation of either Ender himself or his, you know, other employees, basically yeah, other yeah. military persons. And that it is wonderful to like read Graf's sure. dialogue and know that you're being manipulated even as a reader. Mm-hmm. Like he's also manipulating you, the reader, because there are times when he says things that don't even make contextual sense for the character. Mm-hmm. And it's really the author kind of talking back at us. That is frustrating because a lot of times you're like, well, that doesn't make any sense. You know, why would he tell Ender this? It seems counter to what he just said a little bit ago. Mm-hmm. And then you find out he was really talking to, like, you, the audience, and Ender just happened to be there.
Yeah. It's interesting you bring up that manipulation thing because it reminds me really early in the book, right? I mean, boy, I think it's right in chapter one, right? Ender, we're going to remove the monitor and it's not going to hurt at all. And he thinks,
correct.
Well, they always say that when it's going to hurt. So it's going to hurt. So, I'm okay with it. At least I know that.
Right. Oh, no. Within minutes, you find out everyone is manipulating people.
Yeah.
I mean, they take his monitor off to see what he's going to do. Mm-hmm. He figures that out, so he tries to react differently. He's trying to manipulate the system around him.
Yeah.
You know, Peter finds out that, you know, Ender gets his monitor removed and is like, now's my chance to firmly anchor in his mind that nowhere will ever be safe ever for the rest of his life. And that's manipulation on a very yeah. deep core personal level. You know,
yeah.
Val is people like to defend Val as not being a manipulator, but she's the opposite of that. Mm-hmm. Val uses people as her own shield. And it's a very interesting thing when you start to read from the perspective that Val is actually manipulating those people around her to build protection for herself. Mm-hmm. It's not something that she ever admits until like two books later.
Right.
And, you know, she doesn't necessarily say like, oh, you know, I'm doing this for me. Or, you know, I don't think these are conscious decisions when she's a kid, but it's like a reflex because she's so used to Peter, you know, manipulating the crap out of her that she's like, I better do something to defend myself.
Yeah.
And so most of her actions are all about self-preservation mm-hmm. And, you know, defending Ender to an extent. But I think she sees Ender as an opportunity to get out from under, you know, Peter's rule and Peter's problems in a really kind of backwards way.
Yeah. Ender is just such a good character because the empathy that he has, you know, the capacity to understand his enemy. And it even shows that super, super early in the book when he gets the monitor out and Peter's like, all right, let's play buggers and astronauts, you know. And mm-hmm. Ender starts to get into the headspace of the aliens, right? Well, what would they call us? What would they think of us? Because they're kind of bug-like. So yeah, slimy. We'll use that, slimy. And that's kind of the first inkling that he's going to be able to understand this enemy that nobody else can understand because they're so alien.
Yeah, that goes back to, I was talking about, you know, I feel like Card must have used like Sun Tzu's The Art of War as like Cliff's notes to writing this book. Because when we talk about, you know, knowing like the enemy is to know yourself. Mm-hmm. And then the other way around, you know, the more you know your enemy, like the more you can defeat your enemy. And I personally think that empathy or this ability to be able to understand another person is like Ender's greatest strength in the entire book.
Yeah, definitely.
He just gets it. Mm-hmm. You know, he gets people around him. He gets the situations that he finds himself in. And he has enough like precognitive ability to see it generally right before it screws him over.
Sure.
Enough to give him enough time to make like a snap decision. And they're not always right, which I appreciate. Mm-hmm. But he makes, you know, enough of them correctly that he's able to survive and flourish in a bit.
Yeah.
You know, in his environments. But, oh, yeah, definitely his ability to react like that is his strength.
Yeah,
it's interesting. They talk about everyone in this book is a genius.
Sure.
And I know that kind of sounds like a weird trope, but like it kind of is what, you know, it's basically the book. Everyone there is special. And so, you know, how are you special or how is anything special when everyone is? And it's a really interesting idea because they talk about this and they talk about the layers of, you know, intelligence that all of these kids have. And that is something that I really like, because in a world where everyone is special, you know, how do you be the most special?
Right.
And they take some of that fantasy of like everyone is perfect and everyone is intelligent and everyone is this, and really expand upon that in a way that they're like, well, they're not all perfect. They're actually dark, manipulative, sadistic little, you know, kids.
Sure.
Forced to play war games against each other. And then they go even further than that. And they're like, also, there's this other layer of psychological mind buggery going on with the game that isn't a game, that is a game, that isn't a game.
Right. And Graf even kind of uses that about, you know, you're all geniuses. Sure. Yeah. But then he uses that to isolate Ender by pointing him out as the, the brightest one. Right. And
Well,
and that's part of the suffering too, right? That they isolate him because he can pour himself into other people, and Graf takes that option away from him by isolating.
Correct. That was actually one of the things I was going to talk about next, was the isolation in this book, because isolation, that feeling of insurmountable odds, is actually like a trope in this book.
Yeah.
And they use it multiple times and really like in kind of reflections of each other. Mm-hmm. So Ender is isolated in his family, right? Mm-hmm. He's singled out because he's a third.
Sure.
And so, you know, he's immediately the odd one out in his family, and then all he wants is companionship so that he doesn't have to try so hard. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting. I'm getting off on a bit of a tangent, but it's really interesting because I think at like Ender's core, he's actually kind of lazy and just doesn't really want to do anything.
Sure.
But he recognizes that because of the situations he keeps finding himself in, he really doesn't have that as an option.
Yeah.
If he wants to just not end up getting killed or not end up getting hurt. And so, you know, it happens at home, right? Where he's isolated because he's the third and he's singled out. So it forces him to basically cope by being the thing that they try to make him be. In the same thing, Graf immediately recognizes that about him, mm-hmm. and does it to him, you know, on the bus to school, basically right. Day one. You know, he gives him the Rorschach, you're not locked in, you know, or I'm not locked in here with you, you're all locked in here with me,
yeah.
type, like, watch out for this kid because he's going to beat all of you. Mm-hmm. So immediately takes away any chance that Ender has to just kind of like make a couple friends and blend into the background, which is all he wants. Mm-hmm. Like, from day one, Ender has had this giant gold arrow pointed at him that says Wunderkind. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, he's the wonder child and he doesn't want it. Like, he hates it.
Yep.
He hates the fact that he walks into a room and everybody knows that he's different and special.
Yeah. And there's kind of that cycle in there, too, where he's isolated and then the isolation kind of breaks temporarily. And then they move him out of that army. Right. They move him out of his launch group into an army. He's isolated again. And he just keeps kind of going back to that. And just, you know, just kind of when he thinks I'm making a friend of, you know, a lie. But nope, sorry, you're out of that group now. And now he's going to be your enemy because he's going to be in another army.
Right. Yeah. And then, well, and that continues even again, like the moment he gets an army and he's core and things are done, they're like, hey, I'm taking that away from you. And I'm sticking you in a room with an old man. Right. Welcome to your new life. Yeah. And then he meets Mazer for the first time. And he's like, he's almost thrilled to meet Mazer because he thinks that there's this moment where like they may have some kind of kinship there. Mm-hmm. And Mazer basically tells him, don't look up to me. They put me on ice and I'm not a person to look up to. And so immediately like Ender's left to himself again. He's got this angry old bitter man at not being the hero that the guy wants to be and doesn't think he deserves any of these things. And it's exactly Ender. You know, Ender looks at that man and says, oh, crap, that's me.
Yeah. And he can't complain to him, right? Because Mazer can always say, yeah, my whole family died because I went away at near light speed and had to come back and they were all dead. So tell me about your problems.
Right. Like Ender's got nothing on that guy. Yeah. Oh, it's fantastic. And then it's interesting. There's another, you know, trope for that same isolation and yet like wanton for companionship. And Ender starts finding the game and he's going further and further and he starts to actually like find solace in this game, right? Where him and the game have some kind of like an understanding. Yeah. And it's really the manipulations of the dreams and the manipulations of the game coming from the buggers that's going on. And it's really, you know, it's the queen that's clued into Ender in some way, some fantasy, mystical mm-hmm. way. And then the moment that Ender wins, like Ender succeeds and he realizes he's just committed, xenocide. Right. He's just killed an entire species. He looks around the room and goes, oh, crap.
Yeah.
Like, not only am I isolated because I'm now this ultimate evil weapon, mm-hmm. but I have also just found out that I isolated this entire species and they left me one.
Yep.
Like, now he's in charge of that thing's isolation. Yep. So it's just such a dark place. I mean, it's like you feel bad for Ender.
And when he gets to that moment, right, where he discovers what he's done, and he says to them, you didn't want me, you wanted Peter.
Right.
Because that's the part he hates about himself, and that's the part that they needed from him.
Right. Well, and there's a part about that I think is really interesting. It's, I mean, and they tell you it in the book, so it's not like hidden or anything like that. You know, they basically mm-hmm. say, like, they wanted Peter, but without the fear.
Right.
And they say it in so many words, because usually they say something like, you know, well, we wanted Peter, but like without the aggression. No, what they wanted was they wanted Peter, but not someone that you had to be terrified of. Because right. Peter's not okay just winning. He's not okay just being done with something. He's not okay mm-hmm. with just achieving his goals. You know, Peter's the type of character who doesn't want world domination. He wants domination of the entire species. Like, he doesn't want, you know, just to own like an island. He wants to be like master of the entire universe and its known mm-hmm. indigenous peoples. Like, you know, a person, and he's smart enough to do it. So mm-hmm. Peter is terrifying. They can't teach him how to be a military warlord. They'd never win a battle again. You know, Peter would develop his own army and crush the rest of humanity. Like, you know.
Yeah. And it's interesting, too, in the rest of especially the Shadow series, the lengths that it goes to kind of redeem him and show that he has overcome those demons that he had.
Right. Oh, man. The Shadow series is dark. Going into Peter's mind and headspace with him and Bean is dark. And I love it.
Yeah, but I love Bean. I love Bean as a character. And so I really like that series.
Oh, yeah. Oh, Bean is a fantastically written character that shouldn't exist. It's just
right.
Like, of all of the fantastical things that happen in this story, like, Bean is the one that I struggle the most to actually be like, maybe that could happen. Like, Bean, no, it's not possible that you happen. But gosh darn it, do I want to keep reading more about you, because this is awesome. You know, I just love Bean's story.
Yeah. So one thing that I really like about the book, I don't like it when authors over explain things. And though, you know, like mm-hmm. you said, you know what's going on in his head, but there's some facts about the world that you get without awkward exposition. Mm-hmm. And one of the things is like the whole concept of the third, right?
Yep.
You know immediately it's an insult, but you don't know why. And then he very kind of skillfully weaves that in, and you find out, oh, okay, population controls, and why this would be a problem, right, for his family. And that feeds into his isolation, right?
Oh, yeah.
But the other thing is there's really, really good kind of science fiction prescience, because in a lot of older science fiction, you have a lot of really, really bad guesses about what the future was going to look like.
Oh, yeah.
But here, you know, he has the whole, basically the internet is something that he predicts, you know, tablet computing, cloud computing. It's really impressive.
Yeah. So, oh, yeah. Well, I mean, the whole idea of an Ansible is like, you know, blows their minds.
Yeah.
And here we are with cell phones. You know, this idea that you don't have to have like a physically connected line to actually make the call, you know, that you have an interconnected like data transmission service. And it's actually pretty impressive that Card was able to come up with as many things as he came up with. Because, I mean, he talks about like posting on forum boards and things like that. And really, he's just, you know, hearkening back to like community forums where like people would actually post on a message board. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we get those names from those places. But the reality is that, you know, he was talking about like news being manipulatable, and that people's commenting and their exposition on that news in those boards would lead to, you know, like renown. And he was very close. I mean, those are actually pretty accurate representations of like, I mean, you know, like podcasters and YouTubers. And I mean, some of these people are, you know, just as famous as the politicians that they're, you know, renouncing or trouncing or talking about or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I mean, there's I would argue that the 20-somethings of today probably know Philip DeFranco more than they do, you know, any newscaster that's out right now, like local television news broadcast. You know, they probably know who that guy is more than they know who the other ones are. You know, I would say John Oliver is probably more recognizable to them after they put all of his stuff on the internet than when he was just doing broadcast TV.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so in this kind of like weird cyclical way, like, Peter and Val were doing exactly what kids are doing today, where they were basically like, I'm just going to build myself as an internet persona, and then eventually I'll have power.
Yeah.
It was a really interesting concept.
Yeah, definitely. It's funny because now that I've listened to the thing, I actually track all my reading on a little database that I put together. And so, sure. You know, I know that I've read the book 4 times in print, but I have not tracked all the times I've listened to the audiobook. And so it has to be 10 times that I've listened to it. And finally, after all those times, I've actually noticed a couple of goofs in the book. And I don't know if you've noticed anything where you're like, wait a second.
I'm excited.
Okay, cool. I always like to tell people about this. And then you'll notice it next time you read it. When Ender goes into I think it's his first battle with Rabbit Army, and they start pouring out of the gate as soon as the gate opens. And it says that the comment in there is that all the other armies had learned the wrong lesson from Bonzo's misuse of Ender. Mm-hmm. And it's referring back to when Ender just had to immediately go through and go for the enemy's gate to get iced.
Right.
But it wasn't Bonzo who did that. It was Rose. And I think it's funny that it made it through all the edits and beta readers. But I think it's the kind of thing that you don't notice until you've read it 4 or 5 times.
Well, that's a good point. Now I'm going to have to go back and look.
Yeah. Something to look for next time you read through it. I don't know if, you know, Card will produce a new version of it.
I get a little frustrated when authors go back and fix things like that. Not because I, you know, don't think that they should like fix mistakes. It's just one of those, like, I think part of the magic and, you know, some of the fun of books is like that they're written, you know, by a human being and that there are mistakes and errors
at a specific time.
Yeah,
right?
Correct. Yeah. Correct. Yeah. And well, I mean, you know, recently there've been like this movement to update some books, and I'm not going to go into like politosphere of that or anything like that, but you know, to update even like books to have kind of more modern situations, like Fahrenheit 451, people have wanted to like go back and kind of change some things in that book so that it matches some things going on today that were like kind of alluded to in that book and that may or may not like show up. And part of me, like, you know, wants to scream, like, what is wrong with you? Like, that book matters for when it was written.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, don't change it. You could call it something else, but don't like still try to say it's the same book.
Yeah. Well, even Ray Bradbury had ideas that he developed when he was adapting Fahrenheit 451 for the stage. And he was tempted to go and put those into a new edition of Fahrenheit 451. But he said, and I love this quote, I don't feel that an author should disagree with his younger self.
That's a good statement.
Now, I am fine. And my other podcast is all about adapted science fiction. So we always talk about books that are turned into movies or short stories turned into movies. And I like to see some actual adaptation, right? Where you're like, okay, if you want to bring this into the modern state, you can do that. And some things will change, right? Like if it's a book that was written in the 60s, right? And now you're adapting it to be in contemporary times. You've got to account for cell phones and wireless communication and that kind of stuff. And so, some changes can creep in there, but then it's a different medium, right? It's not the book. You're not just rewriting the book to modernize it.
Right. Oh yeah. Well, and if we're going to talk, you know, books to movies, Ender's Game is one of those deep places in my heart that hurts for a movie because the one that they put out was abysmal.
You know, I don't hate it. I kind of did I used to blog a lot more, and I did kind of a analysis of why they made these decisions they made. And I ended up kind of being okay with it, but I feel like I don't think, well, these days it's en vogue, right, to take a book or some other movie series and go, you know what, we're going to make 3 movies out of that. And I hate that because usually what that means is I've got 1.5 movies worth of content and I'm going to stretch it to 3. The Hobbit, especially, right?
The Hobbit. Yeah, The Hobbit. Well, the first 3 Lord of the Rings movies were perfectly fine. The Hobbit was an abysmal failure.
I agree. I stopped watching after the first one because of that.
Yeah. But I got through the first one and was like, oh God, the second one better be better. And the second one was one of the worst cinema experiences of my life.
That's what I heard. So,
it was terrible.
So my point though is, in this case, I would like to have seen them go, okay, we're going to do 2 movies. We're going to do Ender's Game, Battle School, and we're going to do Ender's Game, Formic War or
yes, Command School. 100% agree. It needed to be 2 movies because there's too much to cram into 1 movie.
Yeah.
You know, the honest answer is that they could have done the first movie all the way up until he gets his own army and then the second movie from then on.
Yeah.
Or they could have done, you know, the first movie like all the way up until he finishes like Battle School and then like what happens after that. I mean, there was a, you know, pretty easy break there.
If I did it, I think I would have ended it right when he met Maser Rackham and then drop the curtain, you know, roll the credits.
That honestly that'd have been a great ending. I mean, it would have been a, ooh, you know, what's happening next, and also like feel like a victory and a defeat at the same time.
Yeah. So since I love Speaker for the Dead so much, one of my main complaints with the Ender's Game movie is it does not set up Speaker for the Dead really at all, other than revealing
it doesn't set it up at all.
Yeah. The the queen cocoon exists, right? But you have none of the other work done to set up Valentine as an interesting character at all. And you kind of need that relationship between Ender and Valentine for Speaker for the Dead to have anything.
You know, the honest, an honest talk about the movie. I actually thought that Asa Butterfield was a great choice for Ender.
Yeah.
Which was the, I thought he was a great idea. Mm-hmm. I thought that the guy that they had for Graf, I thought was fine.
That was Harrison Ford.
You know, I wasn't, I know. I say the guy, I mean, like, as in, you know, the actor that they picked. Yeah. I thought it was fine. I don't necessarily know if Harrison Ford was right in my mind, because I imagine somebody who was like a little more disheveled and a little fatter kind of deal. Right. You know, he's more of like an administrator military guy than he is like a, you know, what feels like an old general. Mm-hmm. And so I imagine something, but that, you know, that's personal opinion. I'm sure my descriptions versus what I see are off, but then after that, there were just so many casting choices that I was just like, oh no, mm-hmm. like these are bad ideas.
Yeah.
But going even further than that, they glossed over, and it was because of the, you know, it was one movie and it was like the movie, they glossed over things that are really integral concepts to the story that they just completely cut out.
Yeah.
And so that was where my frustration was. It was like, it has to be two books, because did you see Blade Runner 2049?
Yeah, I did.
Or 45 or whatever the most recent one was. Okay. You know, spoiler alert to anybody listening, plug your ears for a second. But like, that movie needed to be that long and that slow. Right. People complained about that. Mm-hmm. I think that that's what helped make that movie so good, mm-hmm. was that honestly, these are immortal robots. They don't give a crap about stuff being fast.
Sure.
They don't need to go and do things as quickly as possible. They're going to be around for forever.
Yeah.
So what hurry is he in?
Sure.
And people were frustrated by that, because there's the, like this lack of a sense of urgency from the main character. And the reality is that Ender's Game doesn't need to be fast. It shouldn't be fast.
No, there's no way.
There has to be enough like pause for you to recognize the gravity of what just happened, or who just said this, or what murder was just committed, because that's a character in the story.
Yeah.
You know, that little bit of like, oh no, look at what we've done. And then everyone worry about it.
Yeah.
And in the movie, they just kind of like go from thing, you know, they're just like, and he's dead and you're in school and you've killed a person and you killed another person. And then they kind of gloss over it. Like, yeah, that was yesterday. It's fine. Let's keep going.
Right.
And really you never get time to see Asa Butterfield's character, like break down emotionally and lose his mind in a corner of the bathroom, mm-hmm. you know, after he just murdered a kid. They just kind of like go on and he's got a blank expression on his face and that's it.
Yeah. But there's no time for him to suffer and be isolated. Right. And to develop into a leader.
Right. Well, and you never really feel like he's ever isolated either, because he's just constantly surrounded by people saying everything that the book is trying to show you. Mm-hmm. And that's one of my biggest problems. I'm a big fan of show, don't tell in movies.
Sure. Yeah.
If you want to tell a story about something, just show it. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you don't need to like have someone literally talk out their feelings mm-hmm. in the book. You can just give the camera enough time to show you that they're hurt.
Yeah.
But they never do that in that book. And so it was very frustrating to me.
Yeah. So like I said, I don't hate it. And I did want to talk about this. So
I don't hate it. I hate it for what it shouldn't have been.
Yeah. And, you know, and what I mean? That's one of the problems. Right. And I've talked about this on my other podcast called Take Me to Your Reader lots. Right. Where there's properties that I can just be too close to. And there's no way I'm going to give a fair shake to an adaptation of it if it's not exactly what I saw in my head, right? And I've tried to move out of that and to be more on board with there being changes for the new medium. But something like Ender's Game, something like Speaker for the Dead, I don't think I could ever enjoy an adaptation on its own merit, because it would always be compared.
Yeah, no, I would say that there's probably maybe like a handful of books I would say if they ever became movies, no matter how good they were, they probably couldn't stack up. You know, Lord of the Rings, like the first three were really good. Mm-hmm. In my opinion, that's probably the best example of what I saw in my head and what I read and what ended up being in a movie at really about as good as you probably could have gotten. Mm-hmm.
Well, Steve, anything else you want to talk about?
You know, with Ender's Game, kind of my final, I guess my final thoughts, you know, is really like my favorite quote from the book. And that is, human beings are free except when humanity needs them.
Right.
Because that is such a dark statement, mm-hmm. You know, and there's a whole bunch of like communism notes and a bunch of other things going on in there. But it's such a dark statement and really like sets the tone for the book, mm-hmm. where really that's the situation that Ender finds himself in.
Yeah.
You know what? You don't get the right and freedom to be a little boy because the whole of humanity has better plans for you. Like, I'm sorry that you want to be a human. I'm sorry that you want to learn what it is to be a person before you have to be a leader. Yeah. I'm sorry you want to, like, play outside before I ask you to murder someone. Mm-hmm. But no.
Yeah, that it reminds me of that quote from one of the sections. I think right after Ender graduates and Bean is sitting there and he thinks, if someone asked him what he wanted to be when he grew up, he wouldn't know what they meant. Because they've already, they're not kids.
No. And that's exactly the point. Like, what do you want to be when you grow up? And Bean would blink and be like, what do you mean grow up?
Yeah.
Like, I'm there. I'm doing more adult things than most adults right now.
So you said Ender's Game is your favorite book in the series. How much of the actual Enderverse have you read?
I've read all of them.
Including the Formic Wars series?
See, I think you mentioned this to me at one point. I didn't even know what Formic Wars was.
So those books are like a collaboration between Orson Scott Card and Aaron Johnston. I think it's Johnston. I don't think they're written by Orson Scott Card. I think he's kind of put out what the plan is, and then Aaron Johnston is doing the writing. And so they're like the first one of those is called Earth Unaware, I think. And it's the first Formic invasion when they first come kind of on a scouting mission. And then there's another series, and that's three books. And then there's another series that's kind of I think it's the second invasion. The first book in that one's called The Swarm. I did read the first three, the first series, and enjoyed it. It's not great. I had very low expectations for Earth Unaware and really found myself enjoying it just because it's set in a very different, it's set in space, out in the asteroid belt, you know, with asteroid miners and stuff. And so that part was interesting to me. I couldn't get into the second series at all. I started reading it. And I'm like, I don't really care.
Does it feel like it's in the Enderverse?
To some extent, I think, because there are some precocious kids who are characters in the books. But Mazer Rackham is one of the major characters in the first Formic War and then the second as well. So I can't really recommend them. But the Shadow series, I think, is tremendous. I really, really like that series. Yep. I feel like
Shadow series is fantastic.
I really liked it up through like Shadow of the Giant. Shadows in Flight was okay. Agreed. And I know there's another book coming out that's supposed to kind of bridge the two series between the Ender's Game Speaker for the Dead series and the Shadow series. And I'll read it when it comes out just because I'm not really a completist, but for this I am.
Right. No, when I found out that there was a whole nother offshoot, I was like, well, got to read those. And then I found out it was about Bean and Peter. And I was like, oh, I'm very excited. And honestly, the Shadow series definitely paid off. I mean, I was not upset at all in the least reading.
Yeah. And I mean, they're very different than Ender's Game in a lot of ways. More kind of military geopolitical stuff that goes on there, mm-hmm. where the speaker series is more philosophical and more kind of a galactic scale, right?
Correct. Well, I mean, the speaker series deals with a bunch of tropes that are, I mean, not even things that humans have to deal with yet. So, I mean, you know, at least with the Shadow series, like they're dealing with politics and people and humans and human emotions and thoughts and concepts.
What it would take to unite them.
Right. And then the speaker series is like, what would happen if AIs were alive? And you're like, oh, yeah, no,
exactly.
You know, what would happen if AIs were also aliens? Oh, right. No.
What would happen if we found another species after we had destroyed the previous one that we met?
Correct. Yeah. The piggy people were I would actually say that I think that the piggers were a pretty like impressively written alien species, because quite honestly, their kind of mutation and transformation cycle I thought was really cool.
Yeah, it was great science fiction.
Yeah, honestly, it was fantastic science fiction. And the whole, you know, spoiler alert, the whole planting thing was just amazingly brutal.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I loved it. Like, it was like, oh, my God, this is dark and amazing.
Well, and it really calls back to Ender and the fact that he finds himself killing again, right?
Oh, yeah. No, it was, trust me, I was reading it and I was like, wow, that's dark and also fantastic.
Yes.
Because it was dark for a purpose. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're going to like have something evil and grotesque and something like that happen, and it's really just literally for the purposes of the feeling of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, that kind of spoils things for me.
Yeah.
You know, it's a big letdown where you're like, haha, they're evil because they're evil.
Right.
You know, like that's frustrating. Like, okay, really? I mean, that's all you got. Just they're bad. Okay, great. You know, bad guys. But the fact that like the buggers literally thought that they were saving people in a way that absolutely makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you don't read it and you go, really? Come on. You know, you're not upset about it. It was great. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to recommend for you to check out the Ender's Game audiobook and then check out the Speaker for the Dead audiobook as well. That's actually the way that I first encountered Speaker for the Dead was on audio.
Okay. So. Yeah. No, I read Speaker for the Dead the one time and was like, meh, you know, not my favorite. And then I moved on. Yep. So I will definitely, for work, I drive like cross country frequently because mm-hmm. there's different major tournaments all over and we've got headquarters is 7.5 hours from me. And, you know, now we're running a big tournament on the East Coast. And so I have lots of driving time because I don't like to fly. Right. And so I've recently been doing a lot of audiobooks and driving time is fantastic. So I will definitely have to pick that up.
Yeah. And then you can listen to our Speaker for the Dead episode. Ha. Synergy.
Okay, sure.
So kind of as we wrap up here, you mentioned the event coming up, the MVP Open, right? Mm-hmm. When is that?
Like August 17th through something. There's actually two. There's an amateur side event and then a pro side event.
Okay.
And there's sometime late August.
Okay. And is that Maple Hill?
Yeah, it's Maple Hill Disc Golf Course. Okay. Yep. Out in Leicester, Massachusetts, I think. Cool. Or not Massachusetts. Yeah, Massachusetts.
Nice. Any other stuff that you want to promote about events upcoming or anything for MVP?
Yeah, we have a big fan event that we do every year called Jarupalooza. Hmm. This year it's going to be, you know, middle of September sometime, which is pretty much when it always is. But it's pretty much a big festival. Like our fans get to come out and hang out with us and they get to stamp their own disc and they get to throw some discs.
Cool.
And they get to play some disc golf with us. And honestly, it's just like a time to hang out with our fans. Mm-hmm. We really do like love our Gyronauts and think that they're some of the coolest people. Mm-hmm. And so when we, you know, think about what we could do with them and for them, we really just try to like make it be a good time. I mean, that really is our goal, you know, just be an awesome time. And so, yeah, that's pretty much, I would just say pretty much Jarupalooza. Look for that sometime middle of September. You know, we got circuit events coming up again. Big fan of those. Mm-hmm. If you haven't played a circuit event, it's a really good way. If you've never played disc golf, it's a really good way to try out not only disc golf, but like get some discs. I mean, you know, when I first played my first round of disc golf, I think I paid like $25 for one disc.
Right.
And, you know, most people don't realize that the head shop down the street that's selling discs for $25 a disc is expensive.
Right.
And so for the price of that one disc, you know, you can get three and then get to play around. And mm-hmm. honestly, I love disc golfers so much because if you walked onto the course, had never played before and walked up and was like, I've never played. What should I do? A disc golfer would be like, that is amazing. Let me show you.
Exactly. Right.
Because disc golfers just love like getting new people into the sport. Yep. I mean, it's just, you know, it's like the best feeling ever. So if you're thinking about playing, I promise you, if you messaged an event coordinator for a circuit event was like, I've never played before. What should I do? Mm-hmm. They will help you out. And if they don't help you out, call me and I will beat up on them a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
Not actually, but you get what I mean. and tell them that they better. And if that doesn't work, call me again and I'll do it myself.
Nice.
We'll come have a one-on-one.
Okay. Well, Steve, I really want to thank you for joining me. I had a great time. Maybe in the future I can get somebody else from MVP on here.
Oh yeah, I'm sure I'd be able to swing that. And I appreciate you having me, Seth. It's been great.
It was fantastic. So I'll talk to you later. Bye.
Thank you so much.
Well, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that discussion about Ender's Game with Steve. And I definitely encourage you, if you're at all interested in disc golf, if you've never played it, I highly encourage you to pick it up. It's a very fun sport. MVP is awesome. Check them out, mvpdiscsports.com. And I'll put a link to that in the show notes, as well as any other contact information I have from Steve. I think I'll put a link there to the MVP circuit events, because that's a great way to kind of get introduced to the sport of disc golf. And also on their page, they have a bunch of media. And if you're scientific or engineering kind of based, you're going to love reading about the technology that they've brought to bear in disc golf. It's something that I'm a huge fan of. So that being said, of course, I encourage you to go and leave us a review if you like in Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or Google Play, and share this podcast with your friends. If you have nerdy friends, if you're listening to this, I have to believe you are kind of nerdy and have nerdy friends. Share it with them. I'd really appreciate that. That'd be great. So until next time, thanks so much for listening. Bye.